Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Thank you for coming to this seminar on an assessment presentation of Marianism, or the theology and the cult and veneration of Mary in Roman Catholic theology and practice. And I will begin by making reference to a poll that was taken a few years ago in Italy, asking people, when you pray, whom do you pray to? You know, basic question about prayer patterns and in people's lives. And the result of the poll was that 55% of the Italian population, whenever they pray to Mary. That's the first person they refer to, they rely upon when they think about prayer, and they actually pray. And that speaks volumes about the way in which the biblical Mary became the Roman Catholic Mary, from a sober account of a person that is very important, crucial in the gospel story, became a central figure in not only Catholic theology, but also in Catholic practice. And so in this seminar, we're going to try to trace the trajectory out of which the biblical Mary became the Catholic Mary, and to see the different steps and phases by which Mary became and has become what the Catholic Church thinks of her and refers to her. And we have to be aware of the fact that Marianism wasn't born overnight, but it was the result of a long journey, starting very early in church history, in the second century, when the first instance of the beginning of this transformation of the picture of the biblical Mary into something different, higher, bigger than the biblical account of Mary began by in the writings of church fathers like Origen, that makes reference to Mary collecting different accounts of the story of the gospel and addressing the issue whether or not Mary had other children in her marriage with Joseph. And Origen says there are people, the Gospel of the Book of James and the Gospel of James, they say that she never had another child, and actually the people that are referred to as brothers of Jesus, brethren of Jesus, were actually sons of Joseph by a former wife, and whom he had married before Mary. And this is because, says Origen, Mary is virgin to the end. That concept of Mary being ever virgin and having remained ever virgin was one of the first elements that was introduced in Mariological development in this ongoing long trajectory that basically culminated into transforming the biblical Mary into the Catholic Mary. Her perpetual virginity was one of the ways in which the seeds of Marianism became to be employed and developed in Catholic theology. Round about the same time, another church father like Irenaeus of Lyon began to employ analogies, biblical analogies, in his description of salvation history. And so he took the typology of the Adam, new Adam, old man, new man, applied to Christ, of course taken it by Paul, and transferred that typology to form a brand new typology in terms of applying the same criteria that Paul had used in referring to Adam and Christ to Eve and Mary, the new Eve. So it was another instance whereby the church fathers not only began to play with this idea of the perpetual virginity of Jesus, of Mary, as if that characteristic would be necessary to preserve the peculiarity, the uniqueness of the person of Mary, they also began to apply Christological typologies onto Mariological understanding, into Mariological understanding, and therefore using, creatively so, a biblical pattern, refer to the description of the role of Christ in recapitulating humanity and applying it to Mary as recapitulating humanity from the female side. And then it was another instance whereby biblical borders, biblical constraints were forced, stretched to the point of beginning to see this picture of the Roman Catholic Mary beginning to emerge. And then in the 4th century, against the background of the Christological and Trinitarian debates, the Church Fathers began to, in order to strengthen and reinforce the truth that Jesus was and is God, in order to strengthen the doctrine of the full divinity of Jesus, they again stretched the doctrine of Mary a little bit in order to defend the full divinity of Jesus. And that's the background against which the title of the Mother of God, the Theotokos, the Mother of God, the Council of Ephesus 431, came about. In order to reinforce the truth that Jesus is fully God and truly God, they coined this title and referring it to Mary, but with a Christological intention. That is to reinforce the idea that since as Jesus was God, and since Jesus was God, there is a sense in which Mary, the mother of Jesus, needed to be called and referred to as the Mother of God. And of course, there is a sense in which the title is true, to the extent that it wants to point to the divinity of Jesus and wants to reinforce it. But again, you see, if you see all these instances in and on themselves, they are not sufficient to explain the whole trajectory, but seeing them as steps, one linked to the other and one leading to the next, you see that the trajectory was developing. At that point, when the Theotokos title had become part of the dogmatic language of the Church and the doctrinal definition of the Church, referring to Mary as the Mother of God, the mechanism that led to further Mariological developments was put in place. And the mechanism is this. It is a logical device that we normally, or sometimes, we use it in our logical reasoning. And this is called syllogism. Syllogism. And the syllogism is a rhetorical device, a logical device, whereby you have one premise, one major premise, followed by a second minor premise leading to a deductive conclusion. Bear in mind this mechanism. If you want to understand why the Roman Catholic Mary became what she is, you have to think about it in terms of the ongoing application of this syllogism. Premise one, this is the way in which it began to work. Jesus is Premise one, Jesus is the mediator, a biblical truth. Jesus is the mediator between God and man. Premise one. Premise two, Mary is his mother, and Mary is the mother of God. And therefore, what can be said about Jesus can be also said of his mother. Mary is mediatrix. This is one of the titles that is referred to Mary. And if you look at the list of titles that Mary is referred to in Catholic theology, you see that these are all Christological titles. Christological titles that are ascribed to Jesus in the Bible. And with this syllogistic mechanism were eventually applied to Mary, transferred, so to speak, to Mary by way of syllogistic thinking. Premise one, Jesus is mediator. Premise two, Mary is his mother. Therefore, there is a sense in which Mary shares the same title or prerogatives or functions or roles of her son. And therefore, there is a sense in which she can be referred to as mediatrix, being herself a mediating agent, together with the son, of course, not in an exclusive way, but nevertheless in a real way, to the point that Catholic spirituality points to the mediatorship of Mary as the easiest, down-to-earth mediatorial role that is available to the faithful. In the Second Vatican Council, at the end of one of the major documents, the Lumen Gentium, there is a full section dedicated to Mary. Vatican II, in expounding the view of the Catholic Church, the ecclesiological view of the Catholic Church, ended that exposition with a fairly long treatment of Mary. And here we have the list of titles that the Roman Catholic theology attributes or ascribes to Mary. Therefore, the Blessed Virgin, that's the virgin aspect that was introduced by the early church fathers with a willingness to protect her uniqueness and thinking that her being the mother of other children would have undermined her purity and her role, salvific role in salvation history. The Blessed Virgin is invoked by the Church under the titles of advocate. Who is the advocate? Who is the lawyer? Who is our defender? We have one defender, who is Jesus. But since Jesus is the defender and Mary is his mother, therefore Mary is also our advocate. She is also auxiliatrix, that is, helper. And who is our helper? Is God, the triune God, and Jesus, being the Son of God, is our helper. But Mary is the mother of Jesus, is also a helper, auxiliatrix. And she is mediatrix, as we wrote here. So you see, that process was the basic mechanism that allowed the development of Mariological thinking and Marian theology. Jesus is king. He is the King of Kings. Mary is his mother, and therefore she is queen. She is queen. This is the way it works. Yes?
But Mary was born to sin.
Yeah, we will come to that. We're still in the early period. Yeah, that just to establish the mechanism. But that is exactly the same mechanism that led to the last two recent dogmas, which not by chance are Marian dogmas. That is, the Catholic Church has been very careful in modern times to issue new dogmas. The last dogmas were issued at the Council of Trent, fighting against the Reformation and making sure that the Reformation theology could be fought and resisted and discussed and undermined. But after the 16th century, the Catholic Church didn't issue another dogma. That is, a binding, authoritative pronunciation of a new doctrine. It was very careful not to add new dogmas to the existing ones. Up to the 19th century, when in 1854... the Catholic Church issued the next dogma, and it is the dogma of the Immaculate Conception of Mary. And you will be not surprised to realize that the same principle that allowed the Catholic Church, indeed pushed the Catholic Church, indeed demanded that the Catholic Church would further develop its Mariology, was the same syllogistic kind of paradigm that had already produced the different titles attributed to Mary. And how that mechanism goes. Jesus, the Son of God, was sinless, without sin. Mary is his mother. And therefore, there needs to be a sense, there must be a sense in which Mary shares something of the sinless nature of Jesus. Not to the point of making her divine or God, that would not be the case, at least as far as the official understanding of the Catholic Church, that would not break the distinction between the Creator and the creature, but nonetheless, Mary would be pushed and stretched to the point of touching that dividing line, according to the same syllogistic thinking. Jesus is sinless, Mary is his mother, therefore, says the Catholic Church in 1854, Mary, at the first instant of her conception, by a singular privilege and grace, was preserved immaculate from all stain of original sin. She shares a significant degree of her son's nature by way of her being herself being having been protected and preserved from original sin. You see, there is no biblical reference, as your question implied, there is no biblical reference, and even in the prayer that Mary prays after receiving the news that Jesus would be born through her, she calls God as Savior, and she admits she has a real sense of her being under the judgment of God and in need of the salvation of God. So the clear words of Mary herself go against that type of trajectory. But the point is that in Catholic Mariology, it's not the Bible that drives theological development. It is the unchecked syllogistic thinking that goes on and on and on to the point of getting to a dogma. So far, the only dogma that contained a reference to Mary was the decision by the Council of Ephesus 431, where the title Mother of God was inserted. But the other titles, Mediatrix, Auxiliatrix, Queen of Heaven, these are all well used and well employed titles, but none of them is part of a dogma. The next dogma after recognizing the Mother of God title is the 1854 dogma of the Immaculate Conception of Mary. The last dogma that the Catholic Church issued in its history is again a Marian dogma. So the Catholic Church has been very careful not to issue many dogmas after Trent, but it has taken the freedom, the liberty, to expand dogmatically its teaching in the Mariological direction. A dogma is a binding pronouncement that defines the faith. It's not an opinion, not a tradition, not an idea, not a conviction. It is a binding belief that defines the Christian faith. And every Catholic who is coherent and consistent needs to embrace the dogmas because they define the Catholic faith. The last dogma is the 20th century dogma, the only 20th century dogma, and so far the last Catholic dogma that was issued. 1950, prior to the Second Vatican Council, the Roman Church defined the dogma of the bodily assumption of Mary. You see, she shares significant degrees of Christ's titles. And then she shares significant degrees of the Son's birth or conditions at birth. And then she must share significant degrees of the way in which the life of the Son ended. You see, there is coherence if the mechanism is no longer governed by Scripture, but is governed by an internal driving force, logical force, if you like, internal Catholic logic that drives the system to continue to apply to Mary something that the Bible ascribes to Christ alone. And the bodily assumption, the dogma of the bodily assumption goes in this way. By the authority of our Lord Jesus Christ and of the blessed apostles Peter and Paul, and by our own authority, So in this sense, this is in a way the wording of this dogma is put in such a way that there is no reference to the Bible. And that doesn't surprise us, because that's not the point. The Bible is as not being the framework nor the teaching out of which Mariological thinking has been developing, but by our own authority. It's the authority of the Lord Jesus, mediated by the authority of the blessed Peter and Paul, and ultimately by our own authority. You see the chain of authority that goes from Christ through the apostles to our own authority, prolonging that authority in the present day. We pronounce, declare, and define it to be a divinely revealed dogma. There is no scriptural proof, there is no scriptural reference. It is something that comes from Jesus through the apostles directly to our own authority, and we declare this is a divinely revealed dogma. That the Immaculate Mother of God, that is without sin, referring to the 1854 dogma of the Immaculate Conception of Mary, the ever-Virgin Mary, you remember second century reference to the perpetual virginity of Mary, so there is a summary of the long Mariological trajectory here, the Immaculate Mother of God, the ever-Virgin Mary, having completed the course of her earthly life, was assumed, body and soul, into heavenly glory. As the Son was raised from the dead and ascended to heaven with his resurrection body, so there is a way, because she is the mother, there is a sense in which she, after dying, she was assumed, body and soul, into heavenly glory, without going through the process of decomposition, destruction, without being buried. Her body was immediately taken to heaven by way of her being the mother of God. So you see, the complete picture is at hand. It started as a way of forcing biblical data to the point of wanting to underline the uniqueness of Mary. It went on in applying, without biblical warrant, biblical analogies that Paul had used in referring to Adam and Christ. It went on in wanting to reinforce the divinity of Jesus by referring to Mary as the Mother of God, but that title was eventually taken as if it would stand on its own and no longer being referred to its biblical framework, but being a self-referential title that would need to be ongoingly developed by way of ascribing to Mary Christological titles, by way of ascribing to Mary the sharing of Christ's birth, and by way of ascribing to Mary a degree of similarity as far as the end of the life of the Son is concerned. And so, at this point, we can see why, according to Roman Catholic theology, there cannot be Christology without Mariology. You cannot have Christ. You cannot have Christ alone. Christ alone makes no sense whatsoever to a Catholic theologian. Christ is always Christ and his mother. Christ together with his mother. And Mariology is actually the complement, the necessary complement of Christology, is the other face of Christology. So that Mariology is a lens through which Christology can be approached. Christology doesn't stand on its own. It needs this Mariological framework in order to be fully appreciated. And this is that not only has theological consequences, but as the Mariological trajectory was developing throughout history, It was always tied up and accompanied with the development of Marian spirituality and devotions. That is, Mariological thinking was not developed in a vacuum between among theologians, among priests discussing about Mary and her role in salvation history and in the life of the Church. It was a process that was always intertwined and even pushed forward by a growing Marian spirituality. That is, Mary became the recipient of prayers, petitions, devotions, acts of reverence, veneration. And that process undergird the development of theological Marianism, to the point that, as I started my presentation, we now end in majority Catholic contexts, whereby Mariological doctrine can be easily seen in Mariological devotions, to the point that in majority Catholic contexts, when people are asked, if you pray, you know, to whom do you normally pray? The answer is Mary. And there is no sense of a contradiction between having a Christ-centered faith that honors the uniqueness of the person and the work of Jesus, and developing a full-orbed Marian spirituality, which is basically, can be basically self-referential. That is, a faithful, or movements within the Church, or even the liturgy, or even the teaching, can have this Mariological stream that goes on and on, always intertwined with Christology, soteriology, the doctrine of Revelation, the doctrine of the Church, and the whole of the Roman Catholic doctrine. Now, in recent times, that Mariological strength and force was even further reinforced by episodes whereby appearances and visions were ascribed to the revelation of Mary coming to the faithful in certain parts, in certain places, to certain people. So there is the theological development that is the theological dogma. Nowadays is a dogmatic framework. These are not opinions. These are dogmas. And if you want to be a consistent Catholic, you should, together with professing your faith in the triune God, in Christ, you should profess your faith in Mary being conceived in an immaculate way and received in heaven in a bodily form after dying. So this is integral to the Catholic faith. So there is a theological level, there is the devotional level that goes on with the development of doctrine and sometimes opening new grounds for then the theological reflection to work on. And then there is this newer form of Marian spirituality that came about in the 19th century, not by chance. The 19th century was a century where the Catholic Church issued that dogma of the Immaculate Conception of Mary. And several episodes around the world began to to receive attention by the Roman Catholic Church, whereby appearances of Mary were accepted as legitimate and real and trustworthy accounts of visions, allowing the emergence of entire cults, the building of shrines, the development of particular devotions, and moving millions of people around those devotions. We are not far from a one of the centers of Marian spirit, contemporary spirituality, Częstochowa, in Poland, where a huge Marian, not only temple, but an entire compound of churches dedicated to Mary, hosts the picture, the portrait of the Black Madonna. And John Paul II was, the Polish Pope, was a profound devotee of the Black Madonna. And there are streams of people, you know, millions of people coming every year to pay tribute to that shrine in Częstochowa. But just this is just one of the examples, not only in Europe. If you go to Fatima in Portugal, you have another big Marian center where apparently the Mary appeared to three little girls and revealed to them a prophecy about an apocalyptic time whereby the church was going through a strong attack. And that vision and those revelations were accepted as private revelations worthy to be considered as true. And John Paul II, after being shot, recognized that in the fact that he was preserved by being shot dead in 84 was because the Madonna of Fatima helped the bullet not to hit him. And he then went to pay tribute to Fatima in Portugal by saying that it was by the providence of Mary that he was still alive. And he recognized the fact that these prophecies concerning a time whereby the church had to go through a strong and fierce attack applied to his own time. I mean, he thought of himself as being the one that the prophecies of Fatima referred to. So ascribing to Mary a providential role there. And you have an ongoing, again, stream of people going there. But you can go to the other side of the ocean. You go to Mexico and you find the Madonna of Guadalupe. There is another huge Marian devotion there, again with visions, revelations, and an entire spirituality built around those appearances. But then we go also to Brazil, where the Aparecida, the Madonna of Aparecida, in Brazil, is a place very close to the present Pope. Pope Francis is a devotee of the Madonna of Aparecida. Aparecida means, I guess in Portuguese, means the one who appeared, the Mary who appeared. And again, back in the 50s, the story goes that Mary appeared to a small group of humble and poor fishermen. They were fishing, and this appearance came to them, and they told about that appearance to the bishop, and the bishop inquired about it, and these visions kept on coming, and the end result was a huge Marian shrine was built, and an ongoing Marian devotion was established. And the present Pope, before coming Pope, every year made sure that he would go in pilgrimage to Aparecida, the Marian shrine of Aparecida. And he makes, he often makes reference to his devotion to the Madonna of Aparecida. So, you know, when, again, another instance whereby if the Pope speaks of Christ, going to Christ, going towards him, believing in him, is on the other side of the coin, the other side of the card, as a Mariological face. And for him, Christ is always the Christ whose mother needs to be recognized as mediatrix, queen, helper, and ultimately conceived without sin and bodily assumed in heaven. And it's not only about the devotion of the Madonna of Parecida, but if you read all his speeches, and for professional reasons, and I have a commitment to read everything he says and writes. So every day, apart from my daily Bible reading, I go to the Vatican site and they, you know, post the speech of the Pope of the previous day, or the speeches, hopefully one speech, but then he often speak twice, three times, and I go through just to make sure that I keep on trying to having a grasp of what he's saying. And in every speech, he makes reference to his devotion to Mary, this insistent reference to the mother as the mother of all, as the mother of the church, as the mother of the poor, as the mother of the new evangelization, as the mother of the new jubilee, as the mother of those who inquire, as the mother of those who suffer, as the mother of everybody. He keeps on using this maternal language and bringing it into his own reflections. And then we come to the final point I want to refer to before leaving time for discussion and questions, because we need to understand this important element in Catholic theology and devotions and practice, the importance of the maternal element, the motherhood aspect. Catholicism is a religion whereby you, together with the fatherhood of God and the sonship of Jesus, it is a religion that has strongly developed a sense of the motherhood of Mary, as if the reference to the fatherhood of God would require somehow a balance in looking for a mother that would compensate and reinforce the fatherhood of God. And so this maternal aspect founds in Mary the prototype of the maternity of the church, of the motherhood of the church, and the motherhood that every human being aspires to have. It plays with a very deep felt need. When we talk about our mother, we are talking about something or someone very precious. And playing with my mother is not a safe thing to do. You know, in coming back from Korea, the Pope went on the press and he says, "If you touch my mother, I will punch you." No, he was saying, in Latin American ways of doing things, he was saying, "You can talk about everything, and I can be patient, I can bear with it, but if you joke with my mother, and if you mistreat my mother, I will have to react." The motherhood dimension, the maternal dimension, is something that goes very deep in human hearts. And this is one of the reasons of the success of Mariology and Marianism and Marian devotions, because it deals with very deep chords of the human heart. But the implication is that the reference to the fatherhood of God is in itself insufficient to deal with the deepest needs of the human hearts. The fact that God is the Father and He has a Son, and the Son is God and man at the same time, is not sufficient for the human heart to embrace His full humanity and to identify oneself with Him. You always need a mother somewhere that would balance that male-dominated type of spirituality. And so Mary fits something or a very big need in the human heart. But it fits it in a way that is not according to biblical teaching. It fits it by way of introducing into the fabric of the Christian faith and Christian spirituality a very deep felt need in a very unbiblical way, in order that the vacuum that the motherhood, the aspiration of a good motherhood is filled not with the sense of the Father and the Son and the Spirit filling you. That's the language of the Bible. Filled with the Spirit. That's the way in which we can experience the fullness, even in our deepest needs. That vacuum is filled with the reference to a very deep aspiration of the motherhood of Mary, so that she becomes the prototype of the motherhood that we all want to have. And this important element is something very crucial in order to understand Roman Catholic spirituality. There is a strong maternal dimension. And it is worked out not only in theological terms, but more so in spiritual and pastoral terms. In a way that the argument goes in this way, you know, when a baby has a need, who is the first person the baby turns to? The mother. Are you becoming a Marian believer? No. No, but that's you know, the phenomenology of the humanity is a very strong element operating in the whole trajectory of Mariology. So the pastoral application is that the Father is there, but is a figure of authority. He is not always ready to come to you. It is normally the mother who is more approachable, more sensitive, more listening, more helping. And that pattern is translated into the relationship between the person and God. God is a father, and yet, yes, He is helper, but the mother is quicker to respond. The mother is closer. The mother is faster, and she's more concerned than the father. And that, again, is another instance whereby the whole Mariological discourse ultimately undermines the humanity of Jesus and the sufficiency of His mediatorship. In which sense? In the sense that if our deepest needs need to be met by making reference to the Heavenly Mother, it means that the mediatorial office of Christ in His being God-man is not in itself sufficient to respond to our deepest needs. It undermines the priesthood of Jesus in Him being the priest who can sympathize with us in all things. But if you need another way in order to get to the high priest, you're actually sending the message, the theological point, that His priesthood needs to be supplemented by intermediate figures that are closer to you. Yes, he was human. He is professed as being fully human, but practically his humanity is undermined by way of replacing it with the humanity of the mother. You see the picture that has huge Trinitarian and Christological implications. And that leads to the reflection that when, you know, people say with Roman Catholic theology, we share the same Trinitarian and Christological doctrine, and we differ on soteriology and ecclesiology. That is, we share the same Trinitarian pattern and the same Christological framework. We differ on the way of salvation and the way of understanding the Church. This is not quite right. Our difference goes back to a more basic and fundamental level, whereby the Trinity, the Trinitarian nature of God, and the Christological profession of Jesus as being God and man is undermined by the reference to another mediatorial role filled with this mother figure. And this is also very important element in evangelism and discipleship in majority Catholic countries, whereby when we evangelize people and people realize that they have to respond to the gospel, even to the point of breaking from their own previous allegiances, the feeling of guilt of betraying the mother is very deep. You will never betray your mother. You can become angry with your mother. Your mother can upset you. Your mother can make you nervous, but you will never betray your mother. And so you understand how along the centuries the Catholic Church was able to infuse into the very deepest parts of the human heart this sense that you belong to the mother, and you will always belong to the mother. And if you break away from her, you are really betraying yourself. And so at this point we have pastoral issues in order to show by biblical teaching that the fatherhood of God, the sonship of Jesus, the fellowship of the Spirit, these are the ways of receiving the fullness of life, and of course respecting and honoring and admiring the biblical Mary, not forgetting her, not overreacting by way of excluding her, not talking about her, but actually wanting to reconstruct a biblical portrait of Mary. And this is an ongoing task for our witness.